Pushkin. It's been nearly 4 years since Drive-By Truckers released their pissed-off, politically charged album, American Band. That record was their rebel yell, full of songs that reflected life and injustice during the Trump era. And judging from their latest release, The Unraveling, it's clear the Drive-By Truckers have moved from anger into a state of grief. I'm sorry to my children. I'm sorry what they see. I'm sorry for the world that they'll inherit from me. Babies in a cage. The Unraveling is the Drive-By Truckers' 12th album. The band's two lead vocalists, Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood, both grew up in rural Alabama. Patterson's dad, David Hood, was the bassist for the Swampers, one of the most famous studio house bands of all time, who are officially known as the Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section. They backed artists like Aretha Franklin, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, and Paul Simon. But Patterson explains to Bruce Headlam in this interview why he never talked about his dad's job until he was in his 30s. Patterson and Mike also play songs from their new album, most of which are protest songs inspired by the current political climate and conversations they've had to have with their kids about it. And as you'll hear, they've had to rethink their live set list after fans started waving the Confederate flags at a festival they were playing alongside one of their favorite rappers. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood in conversation with Bruce Headlam. They start off by playing an acoustic version of 21st Century USA.
The parking lot behind Oasis 10, down the street from the Mexican restaurant behind the AutoZone. And the place is hawking payday loans. There's a Kmart and a KFC, a fitness center and an Applebee's, Wells Fargo and a Taco John's, a good time bar to get your bad swerve on. In a town that's named for razor blades, American but Chinese made, folks working hard for shrinking pay, 21st century USA. Out I-90 we might see you pass, we got coal and methane gas. We got jobs where the work is hard, and stores to max out your credit cards. In a town that ain't nowhere near, just like every town everywhere, folks working hard for shrinking pay. Say we have to hang on just a little bit longer and a savior will come our way. We'll know him by the neon sign and the opulence he maintains. If Amazon can deliver salvation, I'll order it up on my phone. With Big Brother watching me always, why must I always feel so alone? Men working hard for not enough at best, women working just as hard for less. We get together late at night at bars and bang each other like crashing cars. Working hard but it don't seem enough, calloused hearts make even love seem tough. Prescription pills to make the pain hurt less, till your calloused heart just needs a rest. Look at your children and you hope and pray they can conjure up a better day. No one remembers how it got that way. 21st century USA. Century USA.
That was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're here with Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood, who for more than 20 years have been the leaders and songwriters for Drive-By Truckers. Songwriters doesn't seem to quite capture it, almost. You guys have been so prolific, and you write with such strong themes. It's easier almost to think of you as novelists with guitars, I think, because you've done so much work. Tell me where this song came from.
This song came from stopover on an off-ramp off I-90 outside of Gillette, Wyoming. And I don't write a lot on the road. I don't write a lot of songs on the road because it tends to be hard with on a bus with, you know, 11 people and all the loud noises and music playing and stuff. But we were on our way from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to Missoula, and taking the legally required bus stop where the driver hopefully sleeps for a few hours.
Yeah, those are pretty good laws, actually.
It's a good law. And we've seen the other side.
Nice to know that you're union guys.
Yeah, we've seen the other side.
We've seen not abiding by them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we had a driver one time go from Minneapolis to Seattle nonstop.
Wow.
And, I don't even know if he peed. I mean, he just went and it was a little terrifying, but so we were stopped at a Holiday Inn Express just on an off ramp. I mean, it could just as easily have been somewhere in Alabama or Arizona, other than how cold it was. And, cause it was wintertime, it was January and it was nice and cold and we were hungry and we were going to walk to this like Mexican restaurant a couple blocks away. There was the only thing on that off ramp that wasn't a chain. Mm-hmm. And, it was like 3 stars on Yelp, you know, sold. And, And we met in the lobby and we're walking. When I walked out of the door with like patches of snow and ice, you know, in the parking lot, our bus is parked under this giant billboard that said the Oasis Tanning Salon. And I don't know how that became a song, but by the time we got to the restaurant, I wrote the first verse on a napkin. And after I ate, I went back to the hotel room and wrote the rest of the song that afternoon. Mm-hmm. And that kind of opened the floodgates for the songs that I wrote on this album, because I up to that point was having a real hard time wrapping my head around how I wanted to approach writing about this crazy time that we're all trying to live through right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, your last album, American Band, was also written about an earlier part of the crazier time.
Right. Back in the good old days when we thought it sucked.
Yeah. and, you know, parts of that album seem to be written more in sorrow than in anger. You seem to have become a little easier with your anger in this one. It's a tough, tough album.
It's funny because I almost have taken the opposite thought on it. I love hearing how different people gauge it and react to it, you know, because from my point of view, I thought of the last record as more the angry one and this is more just the sad one. It's just like, now what? What do we do now, you know? Mm-hmm. And so many of the songs I wrote on this record were directly inspired by conversations with my kids and trying to raise your family and, you know, in all of this and you know, the questions they had about different things, you know, talking to, you know, my kids about the lockdown drill they had in school, you know, mm-hmm. And my son had all these questions about, you know, if someone was going to take him away from his mommy and I and put him in a cage and a holding. I mean, he was worried about that, you know, mm-hmm. You know, first I comforted him and told him that that wasn't going to happen, which led to the really uncomfortable, unpleasant conversation about why, you know, and you know, the fact that, you know, they aren't taking little white kids away from their parents and doing that. And, mm-hmm. And the look on his face as you could see him trying to wrap his head around that concept. And it was just heartbreaking to me, you know, and that directly led to, you know, at least one, if not more, of the songs on the record.
Mm-hmm. And some of the songs, and what you just played is not an example of that, but a lot of the songs take the form of really protest songs in a very old-fashioned way, which is something of a departure for you guys.
Yeah, I guess. You know, I've always thought of our band as political and mm-hmm. my songs is political, but, you know, so often it was like, done in the form of telling a story, often a story set in a different time and place, you know, mm-hmm. almost like the Chinatown, you know, the way the movie Chinatown used the 30s noir, you know, format to talk about, you know, what was going on at that time in the 70s, you know, mm-hmm. and so I always kind of took that approach, you know. I mean, I considered Southern Rock Opera to be a very political record, you know, mm-hmm. with all of the George Wallace stuff and all that. And, but starting with American Band, we made a kind of very conscious decision that that record and this last one are set right now. And there isn't some story to, you know, necessarily, you know, ease you into it.
Mm-hmm. We are going to get back to politics, but I do want to ask you just a bit about the making of the album itself. You went to Memphis for this.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that.
We went to Sam Phillips Recording Service studio that when, you know, of course, Sam's actually from our hometown. He grew up two farms over from my grandmother. They're the same age, mm-hmm. and they went to elementary school together even. Okay. And, you know, of course, he moved to Memphis and, you know, basically discovered rock and roll and Sun Studios and Elvis and Carl Perkins and all of that. And around 1960 or so, when he sold Sun Records and the Sun Studios, he took his money and he built like his dream studio. And so that's the place where we recorded our record. It was like a time capsule from like 1962, basically, with some early 70s updates here or there. And some amazing old tube gear and just and those echo chambers he designed and built three different echo chambers of different sizes into the actual building. Right? And so we're like running our stuff through those echo chambers and really digging the way it sounded and kind of being inspired by it even.
Did it change the sound of this album from other albums?
I think it did. I think a combination of that and just, you know, how the band's evolved too, because mm-hmm. we haven't had any kind of a personnel lineup change or anything for about 8 years now, and so this incarnation of the band is just really, really gelled in a way that I don't think we were ever able to quite achieve before, because mm-hmm. in our more tumultuous earlier days.
And I heard there was a celebrity sighting there.
There was, yeah. Yep. Peter Grownick, who wrote the Sam Phillips book, came and visited us, and he had Mick Jagger with him, yeah.
Okay. But did you talk to Mick Jagger there, or?
Yeah, a little bit for mm-hmm. a second, you know, and we knew that Peter was coming, and of course, I'd read his Sam Phillips book. I've read probably all his books, and so I knew he was coming, and I was looking forward to meeting him or seeing him. I've met him before, but seeing him again. But then when Mick Jagger stuck his head in, it was a bit of a trip.
I'll bet. You know, the song you just played describes sort of how homogeneous sort of the American landscape is become. Right. But you guys grew up in a very particular part of Alabama. Now, when you say Alabama to most Northerners, they have a certain idea, and it's probably Birmingham or Mobile or
right.
football or oil or whatever it is.
My cousin Vinny.
Your cousin Vinny. Was that in Alabama?
Yeah.
Okay. They're not thinking Emmylou Harris or, you know, any of the people who are yeah. actually from there. What was that part of Alabama like growing up?
I mean, when we were growing up, it was kind of isolated in a way because there's no major highway through our town. There's a pretty major waterway through there as far as the Tennessee River. So there's a lot mm-hmm. of barges that floated through. But, you know, the closest airport of any size, you know, was at least 2 hours away, and the interstate was an hour away, and we're kind of right between three cities, each about 2 to 3 hours away, Birmingham and Nashville and Memphis. We're kind of right mm-hmm. in the middle of the, you know, of that triangle.
But yeah, the Shoals area, it's four cities all that border each other, but I would describe the four of them collectively as a small town with a lot more people in it than you usually see in a small town, but it's still very much a big small town.
Right.
Yeah.
And it also, I mean, to the rest of the world, because of Muscle Shoals, where your father, Dave right. Hood, played for years and years on some of the greatest soul records ever.
Right. Mick Jagger came to his studio too.
Oh, did he? Yeah, yeah. I should hope so.
But yeah, the Stones recorded Brown Sugar and Wild Horses and You Gotta Move there. And and at that time, I mean, it was a dry county, you know. It was when we were growing up, it was still a dry county.
I was almost in high school before we had legal alcohol
and was that right?
there, yeah.
Yeah. So
wow.
So it was a it
junior
was
high
a,
must have been
just
rough.
In time.
Yeah. They saw you coming. Yeah, they needed to raise some taxes.
I always say the best thing for, you know, for hard drinking teenagers to live in a dry county, because the bootleggers don't care how old you are, you know, and mm-hmm. If you don't have legal liquor, then you're just going to have illegal liquor. I mean, it's not like you're going to keep anyone from doing what they want to mm-hmm. do.
There's a certain image, you know, musically at least, of kind of a racial harmony people associate with Muscle Shoals.
Right.
This is a place that great soul records were made by, you know, biracial bands. And, well, I guess right. the band itself was mainly white, but
yeah,
the artists.
Mainly white, at least Dad's group, some of the later groups, it got a little more integrated. But in the heart of the George Wallace era, my dad was making his living backing up Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett and Bobby Womack, mm-hmm. Etta James, and, you know, all these amazing records that came out of there. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, at times, especially in the earlier days, you know, I don't think some of the African-American artists that were recording there were particularly comfortable going out and having dinner, mm-hmm. you know, in some of the restaurants there. I think it got, I mean, it wasn't nearly as bad there as like what you see from like Birmingham and you know, we didn't have Bull Connor and, you know, they weren't necessarily sicking police dogs on people, but it still was a closed-minded, you know, Bible Belt, religious.
Yeah. I used to have to pass by, there was a radio station pretty much from where I lived to get to anywhere. It was a black-owned AM radio station, so the WZZA, the Soul of the Shoals. And it wasn't uncommon at all to pass by there and see that it had been vandalized again. You mm-hmm. know, some kind of racist epitaph spray painted on the door. You know,
mm-hmm.
so yeah, you had both. You
right.
You had a little of both worlds.
Yeah. And is it changed in a way that we'd recognize from the song you just played? Is it become more commodified and big box? And
I mean, it's kind of gotten cool in a way, because they've, you know, when we were growing up, like the whole music thing that was happening there was a secret. I mean, it was almost like a secret society. I mean, I learned really early on that I didn't go to school and talk about what my dad did. It was not something
really?
I was going to talk about at school.
Because if he were my dad, that was literally all I would talk about,
I know.
Even today.
I mean, it's like I was like 30 before all of a sudden I realized, okay, I think it's okay for me to talk about my dad now. But it was kind of like it was almost like they were in a secret society, because they were afraid if they got too much attention, someone would try to stop stop them from doing what they were doing, mm-hmm. you know. And but they knew if they just kind of stayed under the radar and, you know, and donated money to the little league teams and you know did the, you know, the nice community stuff that, you know, that they could do, they would generally get left alone to kind of do what they were doing. And,
okay. If there is a Little League team sponsored by the Swampers, I want that. I really want that shirt.
At one point, there definitely was.
We should explain Swampers was the name for the what's also called the Muscle Shoal.
A lot of that helped to attract a lot of the artists there too, especially the ones who were on the more famous end of the spectrum at the time. Because I mean, Elton John could probably walk down the street there right now and not get recognized.
I mean, the Rolling Stones stayed at the Holiday Inn right there, you know, right across the river from Muscle Shoals in Florence. And
the first time they've been able to walk around in public in years at that point.
Yeah. You know, Linda Ronstadt, legend has it Linda Ronstadt was the first girl to go sit at the counter at the pool room and order. There's a pool room in Florence that had like good chili burgers and stuff like that. And it was you know, kind of an unwritten law that it was men only. This would have been like 71 maybe when she recorded there. And she wanted to go to the pool room and shoot pool and sit at the counter and did, because Linda Ronstadt did what she wanted, you know. Right. And she wasn't a big star yet, but she was already Linda Ronstadt, you know, and wearing her cutoff shorts, no less, you know, at the pool room. And you know, they served her, and that was, you know, was a pretty nice way to have change occur. But but yeah, I mean, now, you know, it's in some ways unrecognizable to me because it's a kind of a cool town now. They've embraced their musical heritage, and you know, we've got hipsters and a boutique hotel and a fancy barber shop.
Yeah. A barber shop with guys in handlebar mustaches and their jeans rolled up. You know? Okay.
No, it's kind of crazy.
So they've just turned into Brooklyn, what you're telling me.
Yeah,
they'd like to, damn it. Yeah. Yeah. That's Brooklyn kind of is a big box store now. You just find it all over the country.
We'll be back with more of Bruce's interview with Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood of the Drive-By Truckers after a quick break. We're back with Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood performing Grievance Merchants from their latest album, The Unraveling.
2, 3, 4. As there have been stores, lies, and airwaves, what makes a man a man's been right up front. In visions, boys are sold of what it could be. Grievance when it ain't like what they thought. When money and respect seem to elude him, and being white alone don't make a lady swoon. There's no shortage when it comes to hearing voices telling him it's him that's done unto. They say his trouble with the ladies can't be his fault. After all, he's what it's natural they should want. There's just outside forces turning them against him, a conspiracy to water down his blood. Conspiracy to water down his blood, and it's all the fault of it or them or they. Give a boy a target for his grievance, and he might get it in his head they need to pay. For their grievance, and then mocking those who bear the pain they cause. It takes a certain special kind of something to cash the check and bring and sleep it all. The demonizing of the trouble-minded, with all the usual enough suspects on the scene. Merchants selling young men reclamation. Merchants selling old men back their dreams. On suspended disbelief and wishful thinking comes the vision of a special hail for cons. We sell the marks the doubt it even happened. An eternity for every tear they mock. An eternity for every tear they mock. May the price of freedom finally be their own. May our thoughts and our prayers keep them company as they wallow in their helplessness alone. May our thoughts and our prayers keep them company as they wallow in their helplessness alone.
That was Grievous Merchants.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the writing of that song?
I started thinking about everything that went into it. And after that, the Parkland, Florida shooting that mobilized those kids so much, I was pretty moved by what they were up to, you know. But the predictable reaction they got, being accused of being less than sincere. They were called crisis actors. They were discredited, insulted, made fun of. I don't know if that particular shooter or not was one. I think he may have been, but there was a pattern of all these young men that were committing these acts, you know. And every whenever it was over and you'd get a look at their laptops, their phones, what they had been looking at, what they had been posting, liking on social media. It was kind of a who's who of the usual suspects. Maybe not the same names, but definitely the same message. And that was what it all boiled down to me, was this cottage industry whose product was grievance and victimhood. To mostly young white guys, and maybe sometimes not so young. And at that time, that Alex Jones guy is probably the most household name of all of them. I never went far enough down that rabbit hole to even know who most of the rest of the names are, because I just don't want, you know, I don't want that stuff to start popping up on my phone when I'm in public. but yeah, it was that they all seemed to have some kind of problem with women. They had ex-girlfriends, ex-wives with restraining orders. They'd been arrested for stalking. They couldn't get the kind of attention from women they thought they deserved. Their whiteness was losing its value, was the message that was constantly being pumped at them. Mm-hmm. And it's not your fault. Sending them that message that, you know, it's not because you're socially awkward or because you inevitably open your mouth and say the wrong thing. Or because it's got to be this thing or that thing, this ism or that ism that's turning these people against you, and you go far enough down it, and you've completely self radicalized, which a lot of these guys have, and I can't draw a line to people on the internet or the TV or the radio saying something and somebody doing something. Of course not, but I'm not going to let them off the hook either. Mm-hmm. Some of them are true believers in what they're peddling and they're pure evil. And some are just con jobs who are in it for the attention, the money, and the ratings, and they're more than pure evil.
Mm-hmm. Is there, there's a wonderful line in that song, conspiracy to, is it dilute their blood?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah,
it's a great line, but it connects to that idea of lost hand, manhood, mm-hmm. emasculation, mm-hmm. which is very much
needing to see non-white men as sexual predators, and how it's in some grand conspiracy to get white women to have fewer white babies.
Yeah,
I mean they really do. That's really out there. That's literally what these people are feeding off.
Do you think that connects to a bigger sense in the South of being looked down upon by the elites and you know,
that's always been part of it. I mean, yeah, definitely anti-elitism, anti-intellectualism, growing up around, you know, working class Southern white men, there was all at men or who were more educated or more successful. There was always that sense that he thinks he's better than I am. And maybe some of them did, but
he got above his raisin.
Yeah. Maybe some of them did. I'm sure some of them did, you know, or they look at academics and, they think they're so smart. Well, they kind of are. But you know, whether they are or not is not why that person thinks that. They're going to think that no matter what. And it's just there's definitely a blue collar chip on the shoulder.
Well, there's all, you know, fear of the other is such a, you know, which has been a prevalent thing that our band has written about for years and years. That's been kind of an ongoing theme, you know, and our records kind of from about day one. But and it's like there's always somebody to blame, some other that's taking what's rightfully mine or whatever, you know. And you know, and I mean, you know, our current president, I mean, that's how he got elected, was capitalizing on that over and over and over and over. They're coming across the border to get your jobs and, you know, probably take your women too, you know, is that whole.
And now they've morphed into these magic immigrants that can take your job and still not work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you're from the South, you've written quite a few songs where, for example, George Wallace appears. You guys grew up, I mean, Wallace was still probably governor at some, you probably remember him as governor.
He was governor into the 80s.
Yeah. And, I mean, he got elected his fourth term my freshman year in college.
Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, you, and I don't remember the song, but I think you had a line, something to the effect that there's racism everywhere, but George Wallace gave it a Southern accent. I'm not remembering the phrase exactly.
From then on, if you're going to have a racist in a movie, you're going to give them a Southern accent, flat out. It's just, it's like, that's one of the ways that you establish the character of being a racist is you give him that accent, you know.
Yeah,
there's a James Bond movie, you know, Live and Let Die, you know, the you know, they made sure to set it in Louisiana so that the cop could be a redneck cop, you know, they said it. So,
but is the flip side of that, that if somebody has a Southern accent, people then assume he's a racist?
I mean, to some extent, some do, I'm sure,
yeah.
You know, and, I mean, I'm sure there's been people who've never listened to our music that would just assume we're something that we probably aren't. You know, whether it's racist or just, you know, whatever presumptions you want to make about Southerners in the South, you know, and you know, it's like I tell people a lot, you know, it's like Trump won Alabama by 60%, which is horrific, but that's still 40% that voted against him. That's still, you know, over a million people who feel as strongly opposed to this as I do, you know, or as, you know, as someone in a different state does. It's just a matter of how the demographics of the population, how it all settles.
Mm-hmm. But given how polarized the times are now, there is probably not the same audience for a sophisticated, nuanced take on certain kinds of characters. And I'm wondering, another example is you had a song, I think it was Southern Thing.
Right.
Where you wrote about this in the Times, which is that people were bringing out Confederate flags.
Yeah.
And it made you uncomfortable.
I was horrified. Yeah.
So you stopped playing the song largely?
Yeah.
We'll
occasionally play it. And even then it's only in an environment where I feel comfortable with knowing that the people I'm playing it for, know, they get it. They get where I'm coming from with it, you know, mm-hmm. And that song's very rarely played.
Are there other songs that are now in that category in the last few years because of changing politics, things that you may have felt your intentions were right, but it just is not going to be heard in the same way?
Probably. I can't think of any examples offhand, but probably. I mean, you know, in the case of that song, you know, I mean, I'm not sure I did my job adequately in writing that song. I mean, it's got a, you know, it's got a really cool guitar lick, and it was always a crowd pleaser, you know, because it's a good rock song as far as musically on all of that, maybe. But the point I was trying to make in writing it, I'm not sure if I adequately made it. The mere fact that it was so misunderstood always kind of made me question the actual writing of the song itself, you know. The point I was trying to make, maybe clumsily, was that if you ask 10 Southern people what, you know, people always refer to this like this Southern thing. If you ask 10 different Southerners what that is, you get 10 very different answers, often that conflict with each other. Sometimes from the same person, you'll get different answers that conflict with each other.
And depends on what time of the day you ask them.
Yeah. And so that song has a lot of statements that people state as fact themselves personally in describing being a Southerner. That and over the course of the song, there's all these other contradictory statements to that, and I think I really maybe underestimated how easily that could get misconstrued as the song actually making those statements. You know, I didn't view it that way when I wrote it, and when I realized that kind of the hard way, you know, it was specifically a show we were playing at this outdoor festival. In Georgia, in Atlanta, and we were actually on the same bill with Big Boy from Outkast. I'm a huge Outkast fan, and there were people waving. The record was still pretty new then. There were people, you know, with rebel flags, and that like pull them out when that song comes on. And I was mortified, and it's like, wow, people think that's what I'm saying, and that's not. You know, so it's made me question the actual writing of the song.
Oh, interesting. But you are part of the song is in a character.
Sure.
And you guys write a lot about kind of desperate characters, like characters sort of on the edge.
And people tend to not get that.
Really?
Right. Yeah. When anybody does it, you know.
Yeah. You know.
Well, speaking of Randy Newman, Sail Away is not a song I think he'd be really comfortable about playing right now.
Well, it's an amazing song. Yeah. Or, you know, or Rednecks, which is also an amazing song, you know, but it's also, you know, a song that, you know, it's polarizing even to people who do get it, you know. And I mean, when we were writing the record that became the Southern Rock Opera, we spent a lot of time listening to the Good Old Boys album by Randy Newman. To me, that was always the original Southern Rock Opera, you know. And it's just, you know, I've always loved him doing that, his writing of how he can write from a point of view of a character who might be at times a pretty dislikable character. And I think that's a valid art form, but it is something, particularly in these times, it's a risk and sort of you know, I'm still grappling with all of that.
Is that a particular burden of Southern writers? I remember Flannery O'Connor at one point talked about she was always asked why Southern writers always write about freaks. And her answer, and I'm again paraphrasing, was something to the effect that, well, there are freaks everywhere. We're just better at recognizing them. and you guys write about people, you know, who are very sort of edgy characters.
Sure.
Do you feel an extra duty to somehow make them sympathetic?
Not necessarily. I don't know. What I don't ever want to be is condescending to them, even if I disagree with them. I don't want to be condescending to them. I want to at least try to write about it fairly and then let the listener make up their own mind as to where they land about that, which right now in this damn current climate in itself, that is even a risk, you know, and maybe it always was. Maybe I was naive to it, you know, because that certainly could be possible too.
Right.
But I want to be true to what I'm writing about, though, whether I personally agree or not. I mean, you know, I had a very different upbringing than most of the people I know from where I'm from, you mm-hmm. know, but I don't necessarily, you know, need to impose that on all the characters I write about.
When we come back, we'll pick back up with Bruce's discussion with Patterson Hood and Mike Cooley. And if you want to hear more about Randy Newman's Good Old Boys album, check out episode 4 of season 4 of Malcolm Gladwell's other podcast, Revisionist History. More after this. We're back with Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood. Before playing the Truckers' new song, Thoughts and Prayers, Patterson talks about what inspired him to write this song.
This one's not really in a character, I don't guess, but it's, again, it was inspired by, you know, the stuff going on, you know, the shootings and all of that, you know, and again, talking to my kids about it and everything. But this song's called Thoughts and Prayers.
When the carnage was over, you could hear the cell phones ringing. You could smell gunpowder in the air. And on the bloody ground, the LEDs were blinking. Deliver us from evil thoughts and prayers. They're lined up on the playground. Their hands are in the air. See it on our news feed and we cry out in despair. They're counting up the casualties, everyone's keeping score. There is always someone to blame, nowhere to hide anymore. Thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayers. White noise in my head, I think I need a filter, a pressure valve to keep from blowing up. And when the shit comes down, I hope I can rise above it. Hold me closer when I've had enough. Thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayers. Glory, hallelujah, you are in our thoughts and prayers. Glory, hallelujah, you are in our thoughts and prayers. Look at me and they ask me to explain. It breaks my heart to have to look away. The powers that be are in for shame and comeuppance when generation lockdown has their day. they'll throw the bums all out and drain the swamp for real. Perp walk them down the Capitol steps, show them how it feels. Tramp the dirt down Jesus, you may pray the rod will spare. Stick it up your ass with your useless thoughts and prayers. Stick it up your ass with your useless thoughts and prayers. Glory, hallelujah, you are in our thoughts and prayers. Glory, hallelujah, you are in our thoughts and prayers. Glory, hallelujah, you are in our thoughts and prayers.
Thank you. You explained a little bit where the song came from, but I need to ask you where one particular part of that song came from, mm-hmm. which is the just beautiful image of the flat earther, earthist, I guess.
Right.
Realizing the earth is around just before he hits the ground.
You remember where did that come from? Years ago when some guy went way up. It was like some kind of a flat earth thing. It was a guy launched himself and
really? Nearly, no, I didn't know that.
It was in the news right around the time that I wrote the song, and just at that perfect moment when I came to that part of it was time to write a bridge for the song, it popped in my head. I got lucky.
You got very lucky. Yeah. That's that must be the NASA influence in Northern Alabama.
Yeah, putting people on the moon.
But it weirdly, which you've also written about, it makes it a strangely optimistic song. As angry as that song may sound to people, after that, I'm not sure if it's a chorus or a verse, you actually talk about people finding a solution
right.
to all this. Are you actually optimistic? At this point,
I'm trying
on that particular issue or on any particular issue.
I'm trying. It's a work in progress. I'm trying. I do get a lot of optimism from the young people I'm around, and because I'm getting old, but I'm around a lot of young people, probably a lot more than people my age normally are, because I still have small kids. I'm around a lot of their friends. Our house is kind of that house that a lot of my kids' friends feel happy congregating at. And our band's on the road. We meet people all over the country, but we also, our crew is all these, guys in their 20s who are amazing, and I get, so I get a lot of optimism out of that, or what optimism I can hang on to, I guess. I've always thought of myself as an optimistic person, even if I was kind of cynical and maybe sometimes pragmatic about it. I've always felt like I had an undercurrent of that, and that's been a real issue the last few years, because it's taken a real hard beating after, with everything that's been going on, and hanging on to that's been, sometimes I feel like I'm hanging on to it for dear life, like a life raft even. But I'm still hanging on to it.
Mm-hmm. Is it important to you that your music and your shows reflect that?
I would like it to, but mm-hmm. I don't want to be dishonest about it, And so, it's definitely an underlying theme, I think, in this record is the trying to hang on to that. And, I think the act of going to a rock show is a really cathartic, uplifting, wonderful thing. I think I get from going to rock shows probably what some people would get from going to church or whatever. You know, it's always been sort of that thing for me, like that. And I would love for it to have that experience for the people who come to see us play. And, you know, I want it to be fun and there to be some bit of uplift to it. But, you know, at the same time, these are tough times, which makes us need it more than ever in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. The songs are just beautiful.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
It was lovely hearing them just with the two guitars. Please don't say that to the rest of the band. it was great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood from the Drive-By Truckers for talking to Bruce and for playing songs from the new album, The Unraveling. The album's out now, so be sure to check it out along with the rest of their catalog. And if you're in need for a Drive-By Truckers primer, check out our favorite songs in a playlist we made on BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Milo Bell, Leah Rose, Matt LaBoza, and Martin Gonzalez for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music's by Candy Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.